This is the second quantum gravity lecture. What were we looking at yesterday? Well, I very briefly explained what we're looking for when we're talking about quantum gravity, and that I'm really reporting about an unfinished search of a theory which we understand very incompletely. And I also pointed out that it was still partially a question to find what dynamical principles, so what are the equations one wants to solve as a quantum theory are, and if one solves them, that will give one an idea of what one means by quantum spacetime. So that would be a complete analogy with a classical way of proceeding. You have a bunch of equations of motion, Einstein equations, and you solve them, and only then do you know what spacetime is. Now, and I also mentioned our eagerness, at least in the medium to long term, to actually make novel predictions once we have such a theory. Now, an important input into the quantum theory, I said, are peculiarities that are already there, present at the classical level, and to some extent also explain why it has been so difficult kind of to find appropriate quantum theories. So one of them I mentioned was this universality, a feature of gravity that it couples to every and anything, which also makes a strong argument for why it very likely doesn't make sense to leave gravity unquantized of all the fundamental interactions. And there's just one reference I wanted to mention to you where this point is made in a very elaborate way. It's a kind of recent overview article by Richard Woodard, who makes this point. That's on the article on the archives, 4238. And he also, it's also in some aspects a good review article, but he comes from particle physics cosmology, but this is also a review article on quantum gravity from that point of view. Okay, and we also looked at how weak gravity is, that being another kind of defining feature of the gravitational interactions, and you did that also in the exercises. And of course, that partly explains why the scale at which quantum effects are supposed to happen or be dominant are very extreme and, as you said, ridiculously small. Okay, now. You also, in the exercises, started to brush up on some stuff you should already know from previous courses concerning classical general relativity. So I'll just sketch a few things, essentially to define my conventions, because, again, signatures differ by when you look at different books and different people's works. So I'll be looking at the definition of the metric field tensor. G mu nu of x, that's the standard variable in which you describe classical GR. It's by no means the only choice, but that's a standard one. And my convention for the signature, which is called Lorentzian, is minus plus, plus, plus. Okay, part, of course, of being a good physicist is abstracting from the conventions and understand the underlying physics, so, and being used to playing around with different definitions that that people use. Now, of course, this gives rise, the metric gives rise to a definition of what one means by invariant length, which is captured in this usual way of writing the infinitesimal line element, the S squared, S G mu of x, the x mu, the x nu. So very few other things I want to define. Starting point classically is, well, taken to be kind of a differential manifold. So the smooth structure classically is thought of as a given, usually. So let me call this space capital M, and for denoting its dimensionality, And the topology, certainly classically one is always working with, is that of a direct product of either the entire real line, so the time axis, or some interval, open or closed interval of the time axis, cross a three-dimensional differential manifold, where you think of that as being space, and having, of course, an induced positive definite metric on it. You yesterday in the exercises you recalled some of the expressions which are derived from the metric G mu nu. So these are the Levi-Civita symbols, the Riemann curvature tensor, and its contractions. Then you also have the Einstein tensor, kind of the left-hand side of the Einstein equations. So here are the contractions. And really, you use these things so often when you play around with geometry. It's really handy to recall these definitions, these few formulas by heart, as well as some of the more common equations, obviously the Einstein equations, but then also things like the geodesic equation are just handy to have at your fingertips. And very lastly, of course, this whole theory, as also came appeared yesterday in the exercise, is invariant under the action of four-dimensional space-time diffeomorphisms. And these are just smooth one-to-one maps of the manifold onto itself. Okay, and they leave invariant the Einstein Hilbert action or generalizations thereof. And a really useful way to think of this symmetry is also a little picture you had already in Ruth Gregory's lectures, I believe, where you're thinking really of kind of the manifold as being now the abstract, well, as a kind of the physical thing. And then you have kind of points in that manifold. And you can kind of look at a neighborhood of a point. And then what coordinates are, one useful way of thinking about coordinates is just think of it as maps that map, to start with a small open neighborhood around the point P, onto R4, an open subset of R4. So in such a way, so that my point here now has some definite coordinates, but I can just think of them as kind of functions, four coordinate functions, which I'm assigning to a point x mu, which of course enable me then to do kind of all calculations in a specific coordinate frame. So this is, of course, it's called a local coordinate chart. And here my point x mu of p. And this entire neighborhood, let me call it U, is of course also then mapped to some neighborhood of the point. So this is really an interior point of this neighborhood in R4. And of course then, when you're lucky, such a coordinate system might actually exist globally. If you're not, if not, then you have to patch things together in a consistent manner. Now, the important thing is that the actual physics is that kind of goes on here is invariant under the choice of such coordinate systems. So that makes it's made quite explicit by this way of thinking about it. So actual physics doesn't depend on this choice. And that's, of course, the same as saying the theory is diffeomorphism invariant. And, of course, here this left-hand side, before you introduce the coordinates, reflects much more in principle the geometric status of Einstein theory. I mean, if you measure, you know, something in astrophysics, you know, it's not that there are little coordinate lines drawn on your piece of space-time, but you're doing it in terms of invariant quantities. So you're establishing, like, you know, how far away is a certain star by, well, looking at various invariant quantities you can measure with kind of with watts and clocks. And of course, when you do the calculation, you don't get around making a specific choice of coordinates, but then you make one that happens to be convenient, and well, in the end, it shouldn't matter what it was. Okay, now after this very short classical summary, what is the kind of next thing we'll be looking at? These are weak gravitational waves. And why do we look at weak gravitational waves? Well, they're just the kind of this is linear excitation, so it's a linear approximation to the classical Einstein equations, which is good under some circumstances and not good under others, but which at the same time can be taken as a starting point for a quantization. So the linearized theory kind of can be quantized more or less along the lines of other perturbative quantum field theories. So let me specify more right down. So what I mean by this, this is about linearized excitations of the gravitational field. We'll parameterize them in a second. So that's, of course, our G mu nu or equivalent. And they serve, for the purposes we are interested in, as starting point of standard perturbative quantum field theory. Quantum field theory as applied to gravity, and kind of the particles that are responsible for the mediation of forces in this linearized quantum theory, we call gravitons, and we just call them that by analogy with, say, photons. So so these are just then formulated, I may think of it as formulated in terms of gravitons. And here I should say, what do I mean by gravitons? Well, just to be careful, let me write that they are the hypothetical, because we haven't observed any yet massless spin two particles that mediate interactions. Now, let me also make a point clear in order that no confusion arises. So a general relativity, of course, one of the new qualitatively new features of general relativity with respect to Newtonian gravity is that it predicts time-dependent phenomena like gravitational waves. So what's a gravitational wave? It's a time-dependent, so kind of periodic excitation of space-time curvature. So there's a time dependence, of course, something that Newtonian physics can't really capture. So let me just make this point here. So GR is one of the important predictions and, well, when people talk about gravitational radiation, they mean the same thing as gravitational waves. And in GR, so these are excitations that also importantly move at the speed of light. And they are generated by accelerated masses. So, however, again, they're very weak. T typically, even when the source is a very kind of strong force. So of course, any mass that I accelerate, so if I do boom with my fist, you know, of course, I generate and have, you know, I have a moving mass, an accelerating mass, I will generate a gravitational wave. But if you, well, I won't let you do the computation, you can do it yourself, but if you compute, I mean, how strong that wave is, it is just minuscule, right? Now, even, so what are important sources of gravitational waves? Well, they are preferably very heavy masses that move very, very fast. So that are astrophysical objects like binary star systems. So, and what I want to say, well, they generate gravitational waves, but these are not, certainly when you're close to the source, these are not weak gravitational waves. Of course, when you get far away from them, they become weak, and then, well, certain approximations set in. But in order, for instance, what do people do in order to describe a kind of spiraling binary systems? Because they're interested in the type of gravitational wave signal they might be able to see in gravitational wave detectors. Well, they use numerical simulations of the Einstein equation. So they solve them approximately in some clever way in these strong field cases. And only when you get far away from the sources are these things, do they become weak? And the linearized approximation is a valid description. So in general, gravitational waves are by no means weak. However, also, when they are strong, we don't have any exact way of solving the Einstein equation. So we really have to then resort to other approximation methods to do that. Okay, that there are, that the equations predict such phenomena was already obvious to Einstein, right, when he proposed the theory in 1915 or 16. And of course, we haven't yet seen them, these gravitational waves, although there is a bunch of gravitational wave detectors, one of them being LIGO, that is looking, that are looking in certain, you know, bandwidths for these gravitational signals. And for the last, don't ask me, N years, have been claiming to be just on the verge of being able to see them. However, well, there is strong, already strong indirect evidence for gravitational waves, and one of them actually got a Nobel Prize. That is the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. So that's a binary system. One of whose stars is a pulsar. And what you can do, you can use GR to compute kind of the energy loss of this binary system. And the energy loss implies a change in these two things orbiting around each other. And when you compute that just using GR, and of course the energy loss is being radiated away in gravitational waves, I mean, that's the idea, then this matches extremely well kind of the observed behavior of the system. So most people, well, I don't know of anyone who doesn't believe that these gravitational waves are not there, although it may still be some way away to detect them directly in Earth or space-based detectors. Okay, now, so what we can only treat exactly are these weak field waves. So we can, gravitational waves, GW, exactly, so computationally exactly, I mean by this, in the weak field limit. So this is also, you know, in part some things you already learned, I believe, in Rob Meyer's lectures. Let me just recap this very briefly. So what can you always do? So there's no loss of generality. You can start with your metric G mu nu of x, and you just divide it into part eta mu nu, which is just the kind of Flatt-Minkowski metric, and which is constant, at least that's how we choose our coordinate system, plus some perturbation, which by assumption is numerically much, much smaller than the entries, the non-vanishing entries of eta, the eta metric. And now, well, I'm referring to something that, well, you have already been taught, and that will also come back briefly in the exercises this afternoon. Now, using a specific gauge choice, more about this in a second, what this means, so-called harmonic gauge is also called sometimes the Donda gauge or Lorentz gauge, in analogy kind of with a similar gauge fixing one performs in electromagnetism. You can, so what is the Donda gauge? Sorry, what is the harmonic gauge? It's a falling gauge condition. So these are partial derivatives, not covariant derivatives, del mu f mu nu minus 1/2 del mu f nu nu equal to 0. So you simply, you now take these f's as your dynamical variables. I mean, you've just subtracted a constant tensor from your G mu nu of x's, so you know, nothing much has happened yet. And then you impose this additional condition on them. And why can you do that without screwing up the physics, without killing any physical degrees of freedom? Well, this only affects kind of the gauge degrees of freedom, which are anyway allowed by your gauge invariance to change. So, and now let me call this equation star. So, and substituting this gauge condition into, the Einstein equations, and substituting, well, both of these conditions into the Einstein equations, what do you get? So this is exact, right? I'm not making any approximations currently. So you get kind of the box operator. So that's a D'Alembertian on flat space with Minkowski metric, f mu nu, equal to a right-hand side consisting of the following, t mu nu minus 1/2 eta mu nu t plus curly t mu nu del f del square f. So the left-hand side looks like a wave equation. So the left-hand side, this is all I'm keeping on the left-hand side, right? So this is just linear in f, so box on f, my dynamical variable. The right-hand side, now, these are familiar pieces, right? So this is just whatever was on the right-hand side of the Einstein equations to start with, so the energy momentum tensor. You have subtracted kind of a trace part, subtracted out. So this t here, I should say t in the present context is just a contraction eta mu nu t mu nu plus a rest. So the rest is everything that's not linear in my chosen new variable f. Sorry, well, that might be not just derivative terms, right? They can also be just higher order terms, whatever, f squared, f cubed, but sorry, so that's what I'm doing here is wrong. So what I mean here is higher, of course, higher things in f, and that's the important thing, and there's the power of f, not the derivatives, excuse me. So I'm just throwing them on the right-hand side. So it's all the non-linear bits and pieces. So that's one way I can decide to write my Einstein equation. So I haven't done anything. I have just arranged, I have just moved things from the the left to the right. So, well, roughly speaking, I could think of that as my kind of effective energy momentum tensor, which makes one point, namely that kind of the gravitational degrees of freedom themselves generate gravity. Yes, so these higher order terms generate gravity. Now, that of course is exactly what makes the theory non-linear and in general difficult to solve exactly. Now, what the linearized approximation does is it just throws away all of these terms. Okay. So this is, so linearized gravity by definition only keep, sorry, whoops, terms which are proportional to F, at most linear terms in F. And of course, one should emphasize, this is just, well, it's just a truncated version of Einstein's theory. So it's not an exact theory, but it's an approximation, again, which will sometimes be good and sometimes not be good. So this is an approximation. And as you also already know, is that this linearized theory inherits a linearized version of the symmetry, of the diffeomorphism symmetry of the full theory. Okay, so it is invariant under infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. Infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, x mu going to y mu plus equal to x mu plus psi mu of x, where now also psi mu is supposed to be very small, of the order of f, namely. And the associated transformation for f to linear order in f and psi under such a diffeomorphism is f goes to f triple equal to f mu nu minus del mu psi mu minus del mu psi mu. Now, this linearized framework, of course, has advantages because it's just simple to handle. And also, kind of the issue of splitting up our dynamical degrees of freedom into those that are physical and into those that are gauge, so are unphysical degrees of freedom, having to do with my freedom to choose coordinates, is easier to handle in this context. And I'll just have a brief discussion of a general point that is not only true for gravity, but also for any gauge theory, which has kind of unphysical degrees of freedom. And that is that the issue of fixing the gauge. So that's one way of dealing with the overcompleteness of the configuration space you initially started with. So in gravity, there was not much choice, well, but with respect to this particular feature, then starting kind of with these G mu nu fields also, of course, you want them. You want them to have a certain kind of Lorentz index structure, but these are vastly overcomplete. So a lot of information that sits in these GMUs is just redundant. Because, of course, if I apply here a diffeomorphism, then I get to a matrix that might look completely different, but that has exactly the same physical content in it. So I couldn't distinguish between them by making any kind of experiments. So in principle, you'd like, when you, you know, want to penetrate to the physics of things, and if you want to count kind of physical degrees of freedom, you want to kind of throw all these gauge degrees of freedom away. And one way of doing this is gauge fixing. So let's have a look at what this means in general and what it will imply for gravity. Fix a gauge to exhibit what are the true physical degrees of freedom of the theory. Now, generally speaking, so the situation I was describing in just in words for you is the following. So this is my configuration space. So it's an infinite dimensional space. It's a space of all field configurations. So say assignments of G mu nu to my manifold M4. Now, here is a metric. Or now we're talking about the linearized case. Let me say this is now some metric configuration, little f, as captured by this linearized field tensor. Now, this is not an f at a point, but it's a configuration. So it's an assignment of the field f to every single point of your four-dimensional manifold M. Now, operating on that now with my gauge transformations, which are now these infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, will move me around in the space C. Okay? And there is kind of, well, modulo any mathematical subtlety. So if I now apply all gauge a transformation on the single point F, I get to some kind of subspace or submanifold of my entire configuration space that is called the gauge orbit through the configuration F. Right? So this is called kind of the gauge orbit. So schematically, you know, if that was, it's all points, then we call it F twiddle, that are of the form F twiddle is some chosen, let me call this, say, F naught, times, well, let me write it as G. It's just an action of the gauge group. It's not the metric. So G times F, a very formal way, just applying the gauge transformation on your initial F naught, where now G is an arbitrary element of your usually infinite dimensional gauge group. So that's what a gauge orbit is. And of course, your configuration space roughly speaking foliates into gauge orbits that are disjoint. Right? So I've got something like this. So these are all the gauge orbits. And of course, you know that physics doesn't change when you move along the gauge orbit. Now, so what you want to do is you want to, ideally speaking, you want just kind of a cross-section of these orbits. So you want to cut them in some way, say, like this. This would, in a way, that each gauge orbit is picked out exactly one. So exactly, you're choosing exactly one representative from each gauge orbit. Then you have everything you need to know about physics, and you have eliminated all the redundancy. So what I've drawn here, this would be a good gauge choice. Every orbit is cut exactly once. Now, what is a gauge choice? A gauge choice is of the form of some functional of F and its derivatives set equal to zero. That's how you can always write them. So these are just the gauge conditions. So like this is an example, right, of such a gauge condition. Most gauge choices have some problems. So what would be a not very good gauge choice? Well, that would be one where, say, some orbits are not cut by the gauge choice. So it doesn't reach everywhere. So then one says the gauge is not actually attainable, right? Because it just misses out stuff. So this is a, if I had colored chalk, that would be easier to draw. So that's a bad gauge choice. Another thing that can happen is that your functional condition is such that orbits are cut more than once. Things like this. Okay. So there you see, then your gauge choice is not unique. So there is still some residual overcounting here. Right. So this is also a bad gauge choice. Yeah.
Yeah. These are these
regular
derivatives or
regular
derivatives?
Those are regular derivatives.
And is that because they're in first order?
Yeah, because they're in first order. Well, of course, I mean, you know, as soon as you apply a gauge condition like this, by definition, of course, you're breaking gauge invariance. So then all of a sudden, your discussion then takes place also in a specific coordinate system. So you're, yeah, so this is why also not the covariant version appears. So luckily, one can play this out for linearized gravity completely explicitly and isolate the physical degrees of freedom. And that's what one does in a standard discussion of linearized gravitational waves. Yeah. So I won't repeat the discussion here. But if I look at, kind of for simplicity, at the source-free case, so vanishing T mu nu for the Einstein equations, source-free case, yeah, linearized gravity. Then just need to look at this equation. That is what we have to solve in order to, you know, exactly solve these linearized Einstein equations. That is simply the homogeneous wave equation. And well, we can straight away write down solutions, which are plane waves. Now, the only somewhat tricky bit, well, there are two tricky bits, to understand, again, now, which part of the F mu nu is eliminated or de facto unphysical because of the presence of the gauge transformation. And well, this has, of course, a non-trivial tensorial structure. And that will turn out to be reflected in what one calls a choice of polarization for the eventual wave solutions for a given wave vector. So I write, this is, in principle, a construction you should have seen already as part of the course. So maybe go back to your notes to double check that what I'm saying makes sense. So we have here kind of plane wave solutions. And let us choose a wave that moves along a fixed spatial direction, some wave vector k. So for example, let me choose it for definiteness parallel to the x direction or x1 direction. So k is of the form omega 0, 0. Now, what does the explicit solution look like for f mu nu? F mu nu of x mostly zeros. And they're just four non-vanishing entries. e to the I omega x minus t. So in order to get to this form, one has applied harmonic gauge, but this turns out not to be sufficient to fix the gauge freedom completely. In addition, one assumes there are other gauge conditions one then has on the entries of this matrix, and they are called the transverse traceless condition. So what you have, the gauge you have used to get to this form is also called the transverse traceless gauge. Now, transverse, because it's transverse in a three-dimensional sense to this wave vector. So now these polarizations, they just affect the directions which are orthogonal to your propagation direction. And traceless, well, because the trace vanishes, right? So this is A22 minus A22. So there are just two free parameters left in this final solution after I've made a specific choice of k. Of course, for every wave vector k, I have such a solution. But these are kind of the elementary plane wave solutions. So this is a transverse traceless gauge. And in this afternoon's exercises, you look at some of the finer points for why this is actually a good gauge choice. Because, of course, one can make, well, one has to, of course, for each gauge choice, one has to explicitly compute whether it has the right feature set. OK, now, for us, what's important here that are these kind of two free parameters. That are contained in the solution. Of course, what I should also say, of course, writing here this complex phase factor is to be interpreted in the usual way, right? Of course, f mu needs to be a real number. We are talking about entries for the matrix. So, of course, taking here the real and the imaginary part will give you the appropriate real solutions. Now, and these turn out, these two, the number two, this is just translate into the two actual physical degrees of freedom of linearized gravity. So what also kind of follows from this analysis is now where the true physics is. And if you like, for given k, it just sits in a couple of numbers. And that's tantamount to saying there are two local degrees of freedom in this linearized gravity. So these are the true degrees of freedom of gravity. And actually, a neater way to do this degree of freedom counting is in the canonical theory. And we'll get to that. And we'll see that also for the full theory, this is a result that remains true. So there are just two local degrees of freedom in full Einstein gravity after we've done all the appropriate gauge fixings. So this is. So these are kind of the physical degrees of freedom of the linearized theory. So just finally, in the last 5 minutes, let me say something about, I mumbled something that they have to do with the kind of the polarization states of these planar waves. And of course, that is now a bit, well, it's a little similar to what happened in electromagnetism, but it's just different because these are gravitational waves and not electromagnetic waves. Now, what one can read off from this specific form of the metric is that two specific directions in the in the metric space of the F mu nu, so these are, of course, again, symmetric two tensors, are relevant here. So you see, I have one here, entries on the diagonal, and then I have these two off-diagonal entries. And the corresponding unit linear polarization tensors are the following. So if I switch off the A23, this is one linear polarization. And if I switch off the A22s, this is another linear polarization. So, and kind of the direction, the directions is, of course, there's a kind of bivectors, right? Because kind of the direction of the plane in which this happens, the deformations, it can be written like this. So by definition, what I mean by this is the following linear combination . So these are, this is just, you think, can think of them as, you know, basis vectors for two tensors. So these are tensor products of unit vectors in the individual direction, right? So and this is, of course, that corresponds to these two entries here in my matrix. So that's one of them. And the other one is also a unit, kind of a two tensor that specifies kind of a direction in my space of two tensors. It's EY tensor EZ plus EZ tensor EY. And this thing is called the plus polarization. And this is called the cross polarization. Now, what you, in order to understand that, one has to visualize kind of now what follows from this specific form of the matrix element or the infinitesimal line element. So, of course, we've taken out, we still have to add an eta mu nu to this F mu nu, and then we have the line element that's relevant for this particular solution to the linearized Einstein equations. And one, of course, time-honored way is to look at the plane perpendicular to the wave propagation direction and look at an array of test particles that sit on the circle and then look at the effect a passing wave through this fixed plane at some fixed location has on the mutual distances of these test particles. And what these polarizations do is say, well, they affect the shape of these particles, so there's a relative distances. And if you go to the, I think, the Wikipedia entry on gravitational waves or something, you have two beautiful little movies that illustrate exactly kind of these two polarization states. So what this thing does, it deforms this round thing like that, flat. So it, of course, always passes through the round configuration. So it becomes elongated in this direction, and then after it becomes elongated in the other direction. What this does across polarizing is exactly the same thing, but turned by 45 degrees. So then you get the picture, well, like this. So these are the linear polarizations. In general, of course, you can take linear combinations of these, and there will still be solutions. So these are, because it's just plane waves. You can superpose them. You can superpose them with different amplitudes. Now, in order to fix something, well, maybe I should. Okay, let me write on one last thing. That is what one means by a circularly polarized wave is one where kind of this elongation, so this is now the undeformed circle, now where generally it will deform into an ellipse. And whenever this, I mean, it doesn't come back through, it doesn't deform back through the circle, but but kind of it moves, it appears to move either clockwise or counterclockwise, which you can achieve by the linear combination I'm now going to write down for you. You have then the effect of, well, what is called a circularly polarized wave, one way or the other. And the associated kind of unit polarization vectors with that are, I just write down and then we'll just finish for the day. There's unit circular vectors, tensors, excuse me. So these are the right circular polarized waves, E plus I, E cross, and similarly for the left rotating polarization, the same with a minus sign, same linear combination with a minus sign. Okay, and I'll explain briefly next time that these have a property called helicity, and this helicity property is exactly what you find back in the classification of the particle states of your perturbative quantum field theory. So this just reflects a property of these classical linearized waves. All right, very good. I see you tomorrow.